Okay, as usual, we're going to start with a question. Everybody be quiet, please. Somebody brought up a question right at the end of the session. I left it here and I can't find it now. So whoever that is, if they could get me a copy of that question again. Here's the new question. If you all came from Adam and Eve, why do people have different parts of the world look different? Because there's a thing called genetic mutation and these things occur. See, humans are evolving. All species are evolving. That's a natural process. All right. For example, there's a mutation that causes sickle cell anemia. Now, it turns out if you have sickle cell is a recessive trait, so you have to have both of them to get the disease. But if you have just one gene for sickle cell, that protects against malaria. All right? So that's why sickle cell is dominant in parts of the world where there's a lot of malaria, because it provides protection against malaria. Most people who have sickle cell anemia are Africans. I was going to say African-Americans. That's a bad cultural mistake. They're Africans. All right? And so genetic mutations cause genetic diseases and differences. For example, were Adam and Eve darker skinned or lighter skinned? I have no idea. How would I know? We don't have a picture. But presumably, a mutation could cause more or less melanin in the skin. And if you live in northern areas, it's a disadvantage to have really dark skin, because then you don't get sufficient vitamin D. But if you live in places near the equator, it's advantageous to have a lot of melanin in your skin and you're more healthy. So anyway, mutations happen over time. Apparently there's a mutation either to have thicker eyelids or thinner. I don't know which one came first. But Asians have thicker eyelids than white people. There's a mutation either so curly hair is now straight or straight hair is now curly. So that's the deal. Now, like I said, it's pretty easy for people to misunderstand what I said. Remel's son said to me, so if we evolve from monkeys, wait a minute, I didn't say that. Okay, what did I say? Yeah, I have to speak carefully. What I said is the evidence regarding genetics is consistent with common descent. Either way, we did not evolve from apes, because presumably apes and humans would have evolved from a common ancestor, not like either of them. But anyway, I did not say we evolved from that. What I'm saying is this. The evidence seems to be consistent with that idea. I said that I believe Adam and Eve are a special creation. That people created in God's image were created by God. I believe there was a man and a woman. I don't know if their name was Adam and Eve. That's the name they're given in the Bible. They probably just said you and you. I don't know if they even needed names. Anyway, I'm just kidding, by the way, on that one. But anyway. All right. Did the other question show up? Okay. What can you say about Exodus 4:24, where God wanted to kill Moses after he decided to follow God's command to lead Israel out of slavery? Some claim that it's poorly translated. I'd just like to have some clarification on the passage. All right, well, let me read Exodus 4:24. I might have to say, I don't know. I have studied that one out. I believe I answered it at my website once, but I haven't thought about it for a while. So let's see here. Exodus 4. Verse 24. At a lodging place on the way, the Lord met Moses and was about to kill him. Right. All right. And I believe it has to do with the marriage. Something about a marriage having to do with a Gentile. I believe that's what it was. Yes. Right. Because he had married a Gentile woman it was not clear if his son was going to be a Jew or not. All right, and so this circumcision made his son be a Jew, which was important. All right, and I believe that's why this had to do with possibly Moses being killed. Now, I can't fully explain why God would want it to be that way, but I'm pretty sure this case has to do with the fact that Moses married a Gentile. All right? He went over to Jethro. They're not Jews. He married a Gentile woman. So there's the question of his children. Are they going to be Jewish or Gentile? And I believe that's what's going on there. Okay? Any other questions? Go ahead.
Disregarding the if Jesus is descended from David, because it says that he was conceived by the Holy Spirit. So.
Right. So, what do you mean Jesus is descended from David, if it says he's conceived by the Holy Spirit? Now, one of the contradictions in quotes that was on my list I didn't mention is the two different genealogies. And they're clearly different. And the reason is, one of them is through Mary, and the other one is through Joseph. All right? And if I understand it correctly, Jesus is a descendant of David through both sides of the family. All right? Now, you could argue that Joseph wasn't his father, that Joseph was his adoptive father. All right? Because, see, Jesus was the Son of God and the Son of Man. He was the Son of Woman, so in that sense, he's the Son of Man, and he's the Son of God. And so, if I understand it correctly, Jesus is descended from David, both through his mother and through his father. Okay? And it's interesting because Jesus is fully God and fully man. And one of his parents was man and one of his parents was God. And there's the symbolism and the reality of that. All right. So what was your question exactly? So I answered your question. Right. Now, the one that is through Mary, you have to kind of understand how that works. One of them goes directly through all the kings. All right? The other one leaves that line soon after David. The one that leaves that line through soon after David, I believe that's Mary's descent. And then the one that stays through the line of the kings, I believe that's Joseph's descent. Now, you might say, well, isn't that confusing to give his descent through Joseph since Joseph wasn't his father? But it was his adoptive father. And that's part of the beauty of this whole thing about Jesus, is that he was adopted, right? And I think that adoption is part of the beauty of the story there. All right. Now let's get back to why I, as a scientist, say I believe in God. Now, this anthropic principle, anthropos means human. So the name anthropic principle that I already used, which slide? That one here. Anthropos. So it's the principle that the only way to explain why the universe has the properties that it has is because those properties were given to it so that we could exist. In fact, it's the only answer to the question why. For example, if you're asked, why is there gravity? Why is there a strong nuclear force? Why is there a weak nuclear force? Why does carbon have the mind? Every single why question you can ask about the physical universe is explained fully by the answer so that we could be here. Now, that doesn't prove that's why they are what they are, but it just so happens to be the only reasonable explanation. So science, which took us out of being the middle of the universe, ironically, has put us back. Not physically at the center of the universe, because what does it matter physically? What it means is the purpose of the universe points to us. Okay, got it? So like I say here, it seems like the universe is getting smaller again. Not physically, but that it all points towards us. Okay, so that's that idea of design. So the atheist says, accident. A long series of beneficial accidents. No design, no purpose, no good, no evil. DNA neither knows nor cares, it just is. Versus the idea of design. I would claim the level of design of the simplest living thing, it's a little bit more like, you know, like a 747 or something. Anthony Flew was the most adamant, well-known debater in favor of atheism in the middle and second part of the 20th century. A number of Church of Christ people actually debated him publicly. But finally, in 1990-something, he decided that the anthropic principle had to be true. So he embraced theism. I also co-taught this science course I keep mentioning with an atheist guy. We co-taught it for several years. And after teaching it together for 4 or 5 years, he comes into my office, he starts shaking me, says, John, there's a designer. And he reached the same conclusion. All right? In fact, I believe that there is a designer is inescapable. So let me give you some evidence for that. The universe is like a finely tuned universe. Okay, now in this presentation, I'm giving a shortened version. I'm not even mentioning many, many others that I could mention for the sake of time. So maybe you could look at the longer version. It's on my website because I taught this in Cebu a couple days ago. So evidence the universe is finely tuned. Let me see what I got here. Let's see what else. I forget. I actually forget what's in this presentation. Forgive me. You think I would know, but I forgot. Okay. All right. That stuff's there. Okay, good. Sorry. I should have looked at it this morning before I came to teach. I do so many versions of this, I tend to forget what's where. Sorry about that. Okay, great. Now, would you agree that's a small number? Pretty small number, right? Roughly 59 zeros and then a 1. Now, I hear that they do have a lottery here in Philippines, yes? All right, let's imagine your friend won the big lottery. What would be your response? Awesome. Now, wait a minute. You're a Christian. Why are you playing the lottery? See, they got that joke. A lot of my jokes you're not getting. I understand it's because of a cultural difference. So if you think I just told a joke, just laugh anywhere to encourage me. Rommel tells me my jokes really are funny. It's just that you're not getting them. So please laugh. See, they're laughing right now. Okay. Now, what if your friend won the big lottery again the next week? See? Impossible. What if they won the big lottery again the next week? No, you remember the movie Slumdog Millionaire? Yeah. He got so many right in a row, they thought he was cheating. That would be cheating, right? You'd be in jail. The probability of hitting this level of probability would be like winning the big lottery 6 times in a row. All right, so what's that have to do with anything? Well, it turns out, in trying to explain the nature of this event that we call the Big Bang, you have to imagine this thing called gravity. Because this event was not an explosion, by the way, it was a creation. Nothing blew up, it was created. The matter expanded very rapidly, and it would have expanded forever, except gravity causes it to clump. Got it? Now, if gravity had been too strong, the universe would have collapsed. If gravity was too weak, it would have expanded and not formed stars and galaxies. Now, here's what physicists discovered to their absolute amazement. If the size of gravity, the force of gravity, had been smaller, Whoops. By this much, then the universe would have expanded forever and stars and galaxies would not have formed. Now, if the force of gravity had been bigger than it is, by the same proportion, the universe would have collapsed almost as soon as it was created. So I say to the atheist, question number one, why is there gravity? Okay? They literally have no answer. Then if you ask, why does gravity have the value that it has? I guess we're just lucky. That's pretty lucky. So what's the probability? Let's assume that gravity even exists. What's the probability that the atheist is right and it's just lucky? So here's the probability the atheist got it right. Would you want to play those odds? Have you ever heard of Pascal's wager? Pascal said, even if there was only a slight probability that God was real, just believe in him anyway, because the advantages are so great. I don't agree with Pascal's wager at all, because it's just true that God is real. But if you're going to go for this one with that probability, all right? And so this is amazing. This is part of what we're calling the anthropic principle. How do you explain these facts about the universe? All right? Gravity is fine-tuned to 1 part in 10 to the 60th. Now, that's not the only example. There are more than 30 known examples of quantities that define how the universe works, and basically it's most of the factors that govern the functioning of the universe are of this sort. Now, don't try to read all those things. They're a bunch of stuff. Unless you're into physics, you don't even know what they are anyway. I'll just do one example. The nuclear strong force. That's the force that holds the protons and the neutrons together. Otherwise, there'd be no atoms. Now, it turns out, if that force was just a little bit smaller, there'd be only hydrogen. That would be a problem. No life. If it was a little bit bigger, there'd be no hydrogen. Also a problem, because you need hydrogen to make stars. So it's balanced. And the thing is, all of these values are very, very precisely balanced simultaneously in the same universe. Now, if you were tuning a device, the nuclear strong force, the weak force, blah, etc., it just goes on and on and on. All right. By the time you do just a few of these forces, instead of 10 to the 60th, it's 1 part in 10 to the 100th. So the probability of getting the right universe just on 4 or 5 of this list of 30, it's like this. It'd be like, it turns out, it's estimated the entire universe, there's 10 to the 80th protons, neutrons, and electrons, particles. But the probability of getting it right would be, take 10 to the 20th universes and then pick the right electron out of all the universe, all 10 to the 20th universes by accident. That probability is zero. Now, how do physicists get around this? Well, they propose this idea of the multiverse. What they're saying is there's an infinite number of universes and we live in the right one. Now, generally, when scientists propose a theory, it's based on evidence. In other words, there's an observation that they're proposing a theory to explain. But the problem with this is there is no observation they're explaining and there's also no evidence. So the multiverse theory is literally not even a scientific theory. It's sheer, utter speculation created not to explain an observation, but in order to ignore the obvious fact, which is that the universe is designed. It takes a lot of faith to be an atheist. I just don't know how they do it. All right. That was a joke, too. And you got that one. Again, You have to let's say you have all these parameters, nuclear strong force, electric force, nuclear, blah, blah, all these things. And let's say you're trying to get them all right at the same time. See, unless all of them were right, it wouldn't work. So it's not like you get this one right and then separately get that one right, because the thing doesn't work unless they're all right. So this is called fine-tuning. But the precision of this tuning is beyond our mental capability to even understand the level of this tuning. And the atheist says, we just happened. It's just an accident. I believe that that conclusion is not a rational conclusion. Fred Hoyle, the famous physicist, said, a super intellect has monkeyed with physics as well as with chemistry and biology. I'm going to talk a little bit about chemistry and biology in a bit. This is just physics so far. Okay, we could talk about the right kind of galaxy, the right place in the right kind of galaxy, etc. All right, it has to be a spiral galaxy. You know, there's all this stuff about the galaxies. There's all this stuff about the right kind of sun and the right place and the right kind of sun and the probabilities of this being extremely small, the mass, the size, and the temperature, the composition, the amount of water, the amount of oxygen, all these things. Now let's do a little anthropic stuff with chemistry. Do you have any chemistry fans here? Just one, huh? All right. And again, when I teach chemistry, I take the time to point some of these things out. All right, for example, what about water? You could teach an entire one semester course just to explain the properties that are unique to water and why water has those properties. And no other compound has those properties. Well, it just so happens that every single one of those properties, if water didn't have those properties, there'd be no life. That's the anthropic principle. Several things. First of all, water is bent instead of straight. Now, generally, if you're connecting three things together, you'd make a straight line. But water is bent. Lucky for us. Because if water was straight instead of bent, it would boil at about minus 180 degrees centigrade. That'd be a problem for us, don't you think? Another property that water has, water dissolves a wider range of molecules than any other solvent. In fact, in order for life to exist, it has to be somewhere in the range between about minus 20 centigrade and about 80 centigrade. Below that range, there's not enough heat for chemical reactions to happen. Above that temperature, sensitive molecules fall apart. Just so happens that water is liquid across almost that entire range. But for reasons I'll say in a minute, luckily not the whole range. Okay? So anyway, but of all the liquids, there's only one liquid that dissolves ions. Salt, right? Sodium chloride. Sodium ion chloride, remember that? Now, if you don't have ions, then you can't have electrical impulses and you can't have a nervous system. So it just so happens the only liquid that has the right temperature range is also the only liquid that dissolves ions. Okay? Another property of water is that it absorbs more heat than any other substance by far. Most substances, it absorbs 10 times as much heat. More than twice the heat of any other substance. All right, why is that important? If not, the temperature of the earth would go up and down by 200 degrees centigrade in a year, and all life would cease to exist. Now, I used to live in Wisconsin. In Wisconsin, the people are amazing because they can walk on water. In the winter. All right. Now, that's another joke, but it brings me to my next point, that every other substance in the every other compound in the universe except water, the solid sinks and the liquid floats. Generally, colder things are more dense than warmer things. Only one exception, and that's water. All right, whatever. Oh, not whatever. It's essential for life. So otherwise, in the winter, the warmer ice on top and the lakes freeze all the way to the bottom. As it is, the colder ice does not pass heat. Water is a good conductor of heat. Ice is not, and it acts as a thermal barrier. And during ice ages, the oceans would have frozen to the bottom, and life on the earth would have disappeared. Maybe you could have bacteria or something like that. Now, water has a number of other properties, its viscosity and other things, but you get the idea. The thing is, in order for life to exist, the same compound has to have all these properties. So if one compound had the right solvent properties and a different compound had the right heat absorbing properties, there'd be no life. And water is the only one that has any of those properties. And to believe that this is an accident, I believe, is to not be rational in dealing with the evidence. Okay? All right, now, this is the periodic table. Some of you are sweating right now, and you're breaking out in hives. Now, when I teach chemistry, I tell my students that this chart was invented by Mendeleev, the Russian chemist. And that's historically true, but I don't think Mendeleev invented this chart. Guess who I think invented this chart? God. Okay, and I believe that for several reasons. There are at least 20 elements that I know of, but there are probably more, that have a property that no other element has. And if that element didn't have that property, there'd be no life. A good question is, why are there so many elements? Why? Why would there, what would be the reason for that? Well, because so many requirements for life, so we need so many elements. Thank you, God. Okay, one of them is carbon. I teach organic chemistry, and the first two classes, I spend the entire time explaining all the properties that carbon has that no other element has. And each of those properties, if carbon didn't have those properties, there'd be no life. I love this because I get to kind of smile. I don't preach Jesus in my chemistry classes, but my students figure it out pretty quickly, you know? Isn't that interesting? All right? So one of them is that carbon forms four bonds. Okay? Tetravalent, that's the big word. Actually, technically, that's not the only element that forms four bonds. Also, silicon does. However, the problem with silicon is if you make a molecule with two silicon atoms joined together, that molecule is unstable, that compound explodes. So that's not going to really work for what we need, which is to have a living thing. All right, so anyway, why are four bonds important? Because unless you have four bonds, the molecule is not three-dimensional. And we clearly need three-dimensional molecules in order to have a living thing which is itself three-dimensional. Okay? Now, another property of carbon that no other element has is it makes large, complicated molecules. Well, that's obviously essential. Now, if the element that made large molecules wasn't also the one with four bonds, we'd have a big problem on our hands. Actually, we wouldn't have hands, and we wouldn't even exist. All right? Now, there's other properties of carbon, single, double, triple bonds, rings, and all that. Too much technical stuff. So I'm going to go on to my next element, which is iron. All right? Iron, there it is, iron. The property unique to iron is the only element that forms a strong magnetic field. So why is that essential? Well, let me tell you a little bit about the sun. By the way, hydrogen is the only element which through fusion can create energy. Again, otherwise there'd be no life. All right? But it produces a lot of energy. Now, 90% of the energy that leaves the sun is visible light. Luckily for us, because visible light is the only form of light that can instigate chemical reactions without destroying the chemicals. Awesome plan. But there are two kinds of energy that come from the sun, both of which would destroy all life on the earth. So God created two other elements to absorb or deflect those kinds of energy. One of them is sometimes called solar wind. High energy ionized particles from the sun. And the magnetic field of the earth literally is a force field which deflects those around the sun. Hopefully humans will go to Mars someday. One of the biggest problems with that is you're going to have to figure out a way to reproduce what happens naturally on the earth. Now here's something that's so cool about this. It turns out not only is iron the only magnetic element, it's also the most stable element. The number of protons and neutrons in the iron nucleus, that is the most stable arrangement. Guess what the Earth is made out of mostly? Iron. So, if iron was merely the only magnetic element, we're out of luck. The only magnetic element also has to be the most common element. Thank you, God. And again, people who think that this is just an accident, I believe, are ignoring the obvious. Isn't that what it says in Romans 1:20? The existence of God has been clearly seen from what was made, so that people are without excuse. Well, who has the least excuse? Who of all people should know that there's a God? The answer is scientists. And later on, Paul says that they willfully choose not to believe. Exactly. Why? Ask them. Okay? Now, oxygen forms two functions. It's so amazing. Oxygen is the only element that can produce something in the atmosphere which can sustain high metabolism life. That's O2. But oxygen has two forms. Lucky for us. The other form, O3, makes ozone. And ozone in the upper atmosphere absorbs the ultraviolet light, which is the other dangerous form of energy that comes from the sun. Good job. Last example, uranium. There are many others, believe me. Helium, calcium, copper, it goes on. Uranium, you probably think uranium is dangerous because it is. It's radioactive. Now, believe it or not, uranium is not all that radioactive because its half-life is so long, 4.5 billion years. Now, according to scientists, how old is the Earth roughly? 4.5 billion years. So how much of the uranium is still left? Half. And it's still producing heat inside the Earth. Lucky for us. Otherwise, we'd have no plate tectonics. And I think I mentioned this yesterday, right? Without plate tectonics, you have no atmosphere and a sterile planet. So again, good design method there. Then there's DNA. Oh my goodness. I mean, it's so... The level of design here, it's like, it makes my hair stand up. It's like, man, it's a nerd's amazingness. I don't know. Now, you probably know about DNA, right? Okay. That it's the molecule that contains the coded information. And the code allows it to produce proteins, and the proteins do all the work of controlling a living cell. So these different letters, they're not little G, C's, T's, and A's in there, in the microscope. These represent these molecules, and three of those molecules are a coded message to choose an amino acid to make a protein. Now let me ask a simple common sense question. Could a code be created by random collisions of molecules? No! Nobody could believe that. Except atheists. But why do they believe that? Remember I talked about circular reasoning yesterday? Circular reasoning? Circular reasoning is really no reasoning at all. You got that? Circular reasoning is not even reasoning. There's a lot of information here. The human genome with 3 billion base pairs. But, you know, the first life was much simpler than that. Like E. coli, 100 million. Let's drop that to 25 million pieces of information. Now, here is a fact about nature. Nature does not create information. It doesn't. There are no exceptions to this. So where did that information come from? Well, God, obviously. But in order for this amount of information, 25 million nucleotides to assemble in a form that would be usable energy, it'd be like taking 25 million letters, throwing them in the air, and when they fall to the ground, you could read it from beginning to end, and it would make sense. We all understand that that's beyond impossible. All right? But the atheist believes that's what happened. Okay? Next, I don't know if you know this, but the only thing in the universe that makes proteins is DNA. And the only thing in the universe that makes DNA is proteins. All right? So I say to the atheist, you've heard of the chicken and the egg, right? Right? Oh, the chicken and the egg, that's an easy one compared to this. Which came first, the DNA or the proteins? Because here's what the atheist believes. Now, this is going to be complicated, so if you don't get it, you know, it's hard to get this. What they believe is the DNA appropriate to making the protein randomly happened by accident. At the same time, in the same place, the proteins that would have made the DNA, that would have made that protein, also had to exist, because the protein couldn't have been made from the DNA, and the DNA couldn't have made the protein, but they need to match. You know, that's why I became a Christian, because I studied science, and I'm like, now, that more exactly, that's how I came to believe in God. Okay? How I became a Christian was from reading the Bible. All right? And there's the simplest living thing requires a lot more than DNA and protein, believe me. So I don't talk about that. All right? All right. I'm skipping some things here. You know, I was in a van a few years ago, and it's a bunch of science professors. We're going from one venue to another. And, you know, there's this sort of assumption that if you were really smart and really knew science, you would abandon these superstitions, you know, about God and stuff. Because everybody knows educated people slowly lose this outmoded idea of God. And, you know, I don't agree with that, okay? But the thing is, these atheists, they act as if all scientists would obviously agree with them. So anyway, we're in this van, and this one lady says, yeah, Christianity, what a stupid religion. What a stupid religion. I don't know how anybody can believe in that. You notice she's assuming we're all agreeing with her, right? And she said, did you know that in the Bible it says, if you wear clothing with more than one material, capital punishment. And I said, no, the Bible doesn't say that. She said, oh, yes, it does. I saw it at a website. Guess where she didn't see it, you know? I said, you know, people say the Bible has all these science errors in it. I said, I've read the Bible, I don't know, half a dozen times. I haven't seen one yet. I don't know what they're talking about. Can you imagine how quiet it got in that van? This woman's like, whoa. So then I pulled out my Bible. All right? And I needed to find that verse in Leviticus. The one in Leviticus that talks about clothing with more than one material. Could you find that verse? Now, I had read it not too long before. I knew it was on the right-hand side about halfway down. So I flipped real quick, found it, and I read it. Don't be intimidated by smart-looking bald people with glasses, okay? Don't be intimidated by these people who laugh at Christianity, because the fact is, they're wrong and you're right. Okay? And again, science is not the only reason for me to conclude that. Okay, now I'm going to talk about science and the Bible. Now, I've already talked about that a little bit. All right? For example, in Hebrews 11, verse 3, it says, by faith we know that what is seen was created from unseen things. First of all, that's a statement about cosmology, that the universe was created from nothing, essentially. And when we talk about the Christian worldview, I'm going to come back to that. All right, science denied this. Physicists said the universe was eternal. By the way, Buddhists and Hindus agree with this. Now, why did scientists say the universe was eternal? Was it because the scientific evidence pointed in that direction? No. It's because the alternative is that it wasn't eternal, which means that it was created. And that the universe was created, that's not a scientific problem. That's a philosophical problem for atheism. So then the evidence came out. Remember the red shift showing the universe expanding? I could have talked about the microwave background radiation, but you know that's another detail, science-y stuff. All right, and so finally, by the 1940s, science began to accept what the Bible had said all along, both in Genesis 1, verse 1 and Hebrews 11, 3. God spoke, and the universe came into existence from nothing. But there are other things in the Bible. Now remember, the Bible is not a science textbook. So please do yourself a favor. Do not read the Bible in order to gain insight into scientific laws. But it just so happens there are many things that the Bible says which are consistent with science, and I want to talk about a few of those. Now, this is the Papyrus Ebers. It's a medical document from Egypt in the 15th century, roughly, B.C. And it's a summary of the medical knowledge of the day. And historians would tell you probably the Chinese and the Egyptians had the most advanced medical knowledge in ancient times. It's debatable, I suppose. I'm sure the Filipinos had some good knowledge as well. Another joke. Right, thank you. Now, this is the sum of wisdom in medical science from Egypt at the time, roughly, when Moses was alive. Let's look at some of the prescriptions. To prevent hair from turning gray, anoint it with the blood of a calf, which has been boiled in oil, or with the fat of a rattlesnake. Great. A mixture of six fats namely those of the horse, the hippopotamus, the crocodile, the cat, the snake, and the ibex, to prevent hair loss. Now, clearly, I've been using neither of those formulas. All right? Let's look at some of the other prescriptions found in Papyrus Ebers. It includes lizard's blood, pig teeth, rotten meat, the liquid from pig's ears, excrement of dogs, cats, and humans. Now, we're laughing, but really that is not funny. It is tragic. Because most people in ancient times died of infectious diseases. The lifespan back then was probably 80, 90, 100 like it is now. And some people got really lucky and actually lived that long. But, people were dying from all these diseases. Now, if the Bible was what the skeptics say, which is a book written by ignorant people in an ignorant age, then would have things like this, I guarantee you. I have a good friend, his name is John Clayton. He's the most well-known apologist in the mainline churches of Christ. His parents were both ardent atheist philosophers from Columbia University. And he, following his parents' footsteps, became a radical, wild-eyed atheist. He ran the Atheist Society in Indiana. And he was working for Madeline O'Hare, who was the chief atheist in America, writing a book titled The Bible, a book written by ignorant people in an ignorant age. And the process of doing that research, he became a Christian. All right? The difference between John Clayton and these other people is he did honest research. Now, if these other people were right, then the Bible would have things like this. But it simply doesn't. Not even one. Now, Exodus 15:26, the Bible says, God says to his people, if you follow the decrees and laws I'm giving you today, none of the diseases that the neighboring peoples have will come on you. None of these diseases, okay? Now, we're going to see some examples of that. But think about this. Think about this. What cultures have a continuous history of 3,500 years? India, China, Egypt, and the Jews. They don't seem to fit, you know? They don't have this massive arable land and all that kind of stuff. I believe one reason was when they obeyed God's laws, they lived longer and had more children. Let me show you what I'm talking about. One is Leviticus 11. You're aware of that? Some meat's clean, some meat's unclean. You know, it just so happens that every meat on the okay to eat list is relatively safe. Every meat on the don't eat list is relatively dangerous. You could argue for accident or luck, but the fact is all the other peoples ate all these things and they all died in droves. For example, beef, yes, pork, no. Now, with modern safety practices, if you cook your pork all the way through, it's relatively safe. But I would not want to touch raw pork, okay? But beef is relatively safe, even raw. I was in Venezuela a few years ago, ordering off a menu. I speak Spanish, but I didn't, I don't know, just bring me this, please. And they brought me a plate of raw beef. And I thought about Leviticus 11, and I went for it, all right? Now, the Bible says every kind of shellfish, clams, and shrimp and stuff. Can't eat it. Fish with scales, you can. Now, every kind of shellfish has all kinds of diseases. Be careful. Alright? But fish with scales is safe. Even raw. We call it sushi. Right? Now, you could argue, in this case, Moses got it right and everybody got it wrong. That's true. But Moses was lucky or something. But if that was the only example, you could defend that. But once you have 7 or 8 examples, you can't really defend it anymore. All right? Now, you think, well, maybe the Jews were, I don't know, skillful in this area. So here's a prescription found in a Jewish document. Okay? The gnat, feeble creature, taking in food but never secreting it. Wait. Is it true that flies have no poop? No, they do. This thing says that they have no poop. Now, that's a science error right there. All right? The Bible has nothing like this. Okay? Now, is this specific against the poison of the viper? So you have to keep flies around in your house, a little jar. Because if the snake bites you, you have no time to catch the flies, you know. So you get bitten by a snake and you take that the fly, you know, paste and smear it on there. Okay, great. Here's my point. If the Bible was human wisdom, it would have things like this, but it doesn't. Okay? Whoever touches the dead body of anyone will be unclean for 7 days. He must purify himself with the water on the 3rd and 7th day, take some hyssop, dip it in the water, sprinkle the tent furnishings and the people who are there. So if you touch a dead body, according to Leviticus, you're unclean. You cannot be around anybody. You can't attend the funeral, separate from the people. Seems harsh, doesn't it? All right, maybe. Now, this is Ignaz Semmelweis. He was a doctor working in Vienna in a woman's hospital. This is around the time that germ theory was created. He was working in a woman's hospital where the death rate was 18%. Okay? 18%. Okay? Now, what was happening is the doctors would come in, examine the bodies of the women who died, what was called puerperal fever, and they would go immediately up to the wards and treat the women. Imagine infecting them all. So, Semmelweis said, from now on, if you touch a dead body, you're unclean. You wash your hands thoroughly with soap and water. Now, there's also a law in Leviticus that women who give birth are unclean. And even when they have their period, they're unclean. Why would God say that? Because he hates women. No. Because he loves them. Because women are susceptible to infections. Okay? And so, Semmelweis said, even if you touch a live patient, wash your hands with soap and water. The death rate went down to 0.5%. Now, notice, when God gives these laws, he doesn't say why. He just says, do it. So if God commands something, if you don't know why, feel free to ask why, but he may not answer your question. Do it anyway. All right? It'll go well with you. Also, all of these medical principles had a spiritual meaning as well. Do not touch the unclean, right? There's a spiritual meaning. That's interesting. All right? Now, the prescription was water, ashes, and hyssop. Hyssop is an herb, a very, very oily herb. The oil of hyssop contains the compound thymol. Okay, now I teach organic chemistry. We call this class of compounds a phenol. And the first thing I tell my students about phenols is that they're not poisonous, but they kill bacteria. So God's prescription, when you touch a dead body, is to clean your entire body and everything you touch with a powerful antibacterial soap. Because the ashes combined with the hyssop in the water makes soap. An antibacterial soap. Now, if you're going to argue for luck on this one, okay. What about infectious skin diseases like leprosy? Harsh, cruel to the extreme. If you have leprosy, you have to be completely isolated from all other human contact until the day you die or you no longer have this disease. Harsh. But I'll tell you right now, the Jews did not have a problem with leprosy. All right? In the 1600s, there were some monks living in Scandinavia in a monastery, and they were reading Leviticus 13, and they decided to try it as a treatment for leprosy. And within about 100 years, as this practice spread through Europe, leprosy virtually disappeared in Europe. Okay? Another example. Okay, yes, a terrible disease. It wasn't the most deadly disease. More people died from malaria or dysentery or cholera, but it was the most feared disease. All right? Doctors said it's because of the alignment of the planets or the bad air. All right? Or, you know, eating hot food could prevent it. All right? If that worked, then people in Thailand wouldn't have leprosy. All right. Leviticus 17:14. All right. The life of every creature is in its blood. Now, do you know what the most common medical treatment for infectious diseases was in the 18th and 19th century, at least in Europe? Probably here, though Spanish brought some things here. It was called bloodletting. You know the barber pole with the red and white stripe? It's because you went to the barber, not just to get your hair cut, but for the bloodletting. Because what they said was, if you have an infectious disease, the disease is carried in the blood. So if you remove that blood, it helps to cure the disease. These are some instruments used for bloodletting. It's kind of creepy and it's kind of weird. All right? Now, the Bible said the life is in the blood. Medical science said the disease is in the blood. Who's right? Well, the life is in the blood. If you have an infectious disease, your only defense is your immune system, which is found where? In the blood. Okay? But remember, God didn't say it's because of the germs, right? Because they didn't know what a germ was. He just said, do it. And also notice this, there's a spiritual meaning when we say the life is in the blood, right? Last one. For the generations to come, every male among you who is 8 days old must be circumcised. Now that's even before Moses, right? So why circumcision and why on the eighth day? Two questions. Circumcision is a little bit dangerous. However, most diseases in ancient times were caused by bacteria and by fungus. And both bacteria and fungus thrive wherever it's dark, wet, and warm. Now, what's the darkest, wettest, warmest place on a guy? Well, that depends on you if you still have the foreskin or not, all right? So, how many lives were saved? Millions. Especially women's lives. Especially women's lives. Several studies. It's funny, when this first came out, people tried to deny it. Because they want to say that circumcision is just barbarity, religious barbarity. It is not religious barbarity. Several studies show that AIDS is passed 60% less from male to female if there is a circumcision. So that in Africa, they're circumcising adults. Ouch. Much better to do it when you're a child. All right, so Again, I don't know if that's why, but it does provide a medical explanation. So why the eighth day? Well, it turns out vitamin K does not pass through the placenta to the child. And vitamin K does not cause blood clots. It causes prothrombin, the protein to be produced that causes blood clots. When a baby is born, they have low prothrombin levels. So if you were to circumcise them, that would be very, very dangerous. They would bleed out. Okay? Now, where do they get the vitamin K from? From bacteria in your large intestine. So the baby comes out, eats from mommy, gets bacteria, starts producing vitamin K, and the prothrombin goes up to higher than normal levels, and then it drops down to normal levels. I'm going to show you a graph, prothrombin level versus time from when you're born. And there it is. Circumcision on the second and third day is even more unsafe than on the first day. From the day a male child is born till the day they die, what would be the safest day to perform a circumcision? The eighth day. Now, when children are born in hospitals today, they give them a vitamin K shot. All right? So no problem. So if you're going to have your male child circumcised, don't worry. Now, is that necessary today? First of all, it's not a Christian teaching. Second of all, guys, do you take a shower? All right. So the advantages are less. By the way, you know, circumcision prevents AIDS. But there's another law in the Bible that's 100% preventing the spread of AIDS. You know what it's called, right? It's called one man, one woman for life. Prevents so many diseases, both physically and psychologically. So how did Abraham figure this out? This is another joke. This is a science joke. So he did a carefully controlled double-blind experiment. No? Okay. There are other things in the Bible, such as the water cycle, things about the earth being circular. Now, I'm almost done talking about science and religion. I've got one little more section here. I want to talk about what other world religions have to say about things that are relevant to science. Because like I said, actually I didn't say it, so let me say it now. From the facts about science, remember the fine-tuning and the water and the DNA, that doesn't tell you to be a Christian. What it tells you is, yes, there is a creator. That creator is very powerful and very smart. But which creator? Okay? Which creator? Brahman? I don't know, Allah? Which religion shows evidence of somehow that creator working through that religion? Now, I've already shown you some pretty good evidence that the Bible reflects that because of these medical knowledge. All right? Now, let's talk about other religions. I'm not here to put down other religions, but just to kind of talk about how other religions describe the universe and whether or not that description can be resolved with science. All right? All right. So, Hinduism. Hinduism teaches that time is cyclic. You know, that wheel thing, right? That wheel thing. There are cycles of creation, being sustained, and then being destroyed. Shiva, Brahman, and the other one. Shiva, Brahman, and the other one. Vishnu. Thank you. All right, and so that Shiva's the destroyer, right? Oh, it says it right there. No wonder you do. All right. And there are cycles of creation, and you know they have all this bizarre stuff about 4 million years is one Brahma day, and all these Brahma years, and blah blah blah. All this kind of really wacky stuff. Okay? So basically then, one cycle, according to certain Hebrew texts, would amount to 311 trillion years, and then God starts all over again, and he recreates everything. Brahman is reborn, and all that stuff. Also, according to his Hindu cosmology, there are many different levels of reality. And every succeeding lower level is more physical. And every succeeding higher level is less physical and more spiritual. Also, Hinduism teaches that the physical world is an illusion. That it's not real. Alright? But none of these things are true. Matter is real. The universe is not eternal. All right? And there's no evidence of any other levels of reality. All these things are essential to Hinduism, and all of them are not true. I don't know. Now, if you go to Cambodia, they have this amazing temple, Angkor Wat. And that is a picture of the universe according to Hinduism, with the different levels. And if you look at the carvings on the side, it shows the three levels and the carnal level and the earthly level and all that kind of stuff. All this is a picture of the universe according to Hinduism. But there's one problem. None of it's true. The cosmology of the Bible is consistent with what we know. The cosmology of Hinduism is simply not even true. I don't know. That'd be a problem for me. In the sutras, it pictures the earth on the back of four elephants standing on top of a turtle swimming in a sea of milk. I don't know. What the Bible says is the earth is suspended on nothing. Wow. What an insight. No other ancient people had that insight. That's interesting. All right, there you go. We could talk about Jaina cosmology. We could talk about Buddhist cosmology with different planes of existence, each with a different realm. Each one is more blissful. The lower one's more like hell. Endless cycle of time, cosmic wheel. That's that, the Buddhist prayer wheel, all that stuff. Very similar to Hindu cosmology. I was in a Buddhist temple, and here's their cosmology. Here are those different levels. I believe we're somewhere in here, I think. All right, what's wrong with that cosmology? It's not true. Here's Borobudur in Indonesia. It's a picture of Buddhist cosmology. Also not true. All right? Can you take Eastern religions seriously as offering truth, even based on science, never mind other aspects that I'll talk about later? Personally, I don't think you can. Then there's Islamic cosmology. Now, Islamic cosmology is more similar to biblical cosmology. For example, according to Islamic cosmology, the universe was created out of nothing. Awesome. That's good. But according to the Quran, There's a crystal sphere that surrounds the earth, and the stars are embedded in that sphere. And at least one of the surahs, a piece of that crystal sphere falls to the earth and hits somebody and kills them. All right. Basically, the sky is falling. All right. That's in the Quran. Now, I'm telling you, the earth is not surrounded by a crystal sphere. And the earth is not the center of the universe. The Quran is committed to that. The Bible is not. Now, if you hear Muslims, they'll try to tell you that the Quran is full of amazing, scientifically accurate stuff. Well, I would caution you to read their examples. And they're so bad that I'm tempted to laugh. I wouldn't do that, though, seriously, because, you know, I think we do need to try our best to be respectful. So to simply say, look, this is not evidence of inspiration. It's just not. All right? So, for example, in Surah 23:14, it says that humans come from a clot of blood. In Surah 28, Ayat 86, it says, people traveled to the west and they found the place where the sun sets. And it sets in a swamp. Okay? That's problematic. All right. The Quran also has different levels. In Surah 39:49, a piece of the sky falls and it kills somebody. In Surah 36:4, the man deposits the baby into the woman, which was the accepted idea of the day, but it's not true. All right. Good. So that ends this session. Wow, we ended in... Oh, wait, we started at 1:30. Oh, we went long. Oh, no wonder people are getting a little antsy. My apology. All right, break. 10 minutes. A good full 10 minutes, though, because we went a long time.